countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Have you cattle to sell? Find out what they're worth with our marked price calculator on farmersjournal.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, a difficult week for horse racing as we look ahead to a different Cheltenham. John Creedon on his new series of Creedon's Atlas. Ella walks a farm in Shanna Golden. And Maura McElhone reflects on being a new mother over the past year.
Text 51551. Email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, since the turn of the century, there has been a 10-year rolling roadmap to help navigate the broad agri-food sector in this country. And with exports of 13 billion euros, including over 85% of what Irish farmers produce, the journey of Irish food from farm to fork is complex and requires considerable forward planning. Now, the latest incarnation of this process is titled Agri-Strategy 2030, bringing together stakeholders from across the agriculture and food spectrum.
It's really, as you say, to chart the future of the Irish agri-food sector up till 2030. I think the essential purpose of our committee is to see how Ireland can go from being good to being great over the next decade.
Just over a year ago, eminent agri-economist and public policy advisor Tom Arnold was appointed to chair the Agri-Food Strategy Stakeholder Committee, charged with assessing the challenges and opportunities facing the sector over the next decade. Here he is speaking to Countrywide in January of last year.
And I think the essential way forward here is that indeed agriculture has to do more to reduce its own emissions, but we also have to have a roadmap for how the sector can capture more carbon. And those twin tracks, I think, are the way forward, and I suspect that's what our committee will be looking at.
But farm organisations, private food companies, Chagask, the EPA, Bord Bia and the Environmental Pillar, representing 32 environmental NGOs, among others, made up the committee, which worked to draft a strategy over the past 12 months or so. Its remit includes developing and sustaining global export markets, producer viability, and mitigating against environmental destruction. However, last week, the Environmental Pillar said it was reluctantly withdrawing, stating that the draft report, quote, is woefully inadequate to meet the social and environmental challenges we face.
What we need to see, and what wasn't in there, was a roadmap for the sector to come into line with our water, air, climate and biodiversity commitments.
The committee has been tasked with proposing a vision to reduce emissions and reverse and restore biodiversity decline. It's believed this includes a target of carbon neutrality by 2050. But according to Una Duggan of Birdwatch Ireland, the draft paper presented to the committee last week shows no let-up on business as usual.
We didn't see much focus on supporting smaller farmers in the strategy, and that was really worrying as well. So we just couldn't put our name to that strategy, which doesn't really address the seriousness of the situation we're in.
The phrase industrial agri has been used quite a lot by the Environmental Pillar. How do you quantify industrial agri in the context of Irish farms?
So I suppose, I mean, Ireland doesn't really look like the Texas model of industrial agriculture that you see, and that's a fair point. But what we do see is a very resource-intensive sector, and it relies on excessive nutrient inputs and stocking rates, and then releases an unsustainable amount of waste to air and water and soil. So I suppose that's how we'd quantify it here, it's a resource-intensive model of agriculture. And it's really, when you see the image of our Irish agriculture as being grass-fed, and we know it is grass-fed, a lot of it, it's actually really fertilizer-fed. And this is kind of, you know, lost in that description. And then on the flip side, we have livestock farming that, you know, it doesn't have to be intensive. There's a lot of examples of high nature value, low input, low-intensity farmers out there that are just they're farming with nature, not getting the recognised support that they should be getting.
Thomas Duffy is a dairy farmer on the Cavan Mead border. He's also president of Macro na Ferma, and he too sits on the Agri-Food Strategy Committee.
When you are in a discussion with a number of different stakeholders, from our point of view, our focus is going to be on environmental sustainability, but also farmer viability and also generational renewal. And not every stakeholder will get everything that they really are hoping to get as the number one priority. And we have to compromise to achieve those things. We can't have environmental sustainability which doesn't provide for farmer viability.
But the environmental pillar will say that agriculture is just paying lip service to sustainability, and that this is evidenced in the draft report.
I don't agree. I think certainly we are only at the very start of a journey, and there are very key challenges. The expansion of the national dairy herd has happened. It will not continue at the same rate. Now we need to find ways to mitigate the emissions intensity, but certainly proposals in terms of limiting or decreasing the issues that could crop up immediately around that. Who says which farmer gets to keep the same number of animals? How is that applied? Is it going to be the same for small farms as for large farms? What about higher stock farms, lower stock farms? And what about places where the emissions intensity per kg of beef may be very high, but it's necessary for the ecosystem in the case of high nature value farming? So there's a number of complexities when you get into that. I think it's what's far more important is getting farmer buy-in, and that is happening.
The catastrophic losses that we've seen over past decades have not recovered. And recently common species like kestrel and stock dove are now in decline too. So we really do need farmers to help with restoring farmland biodiversity. And that is often in relation to threatened species. But we really need locally adapted farming for nature measures to support this, and a new delivery model. So then in relation to water, there are some initiatives happening. We recognise those, but yet again, we're not seeing the results yet. So that's where we're concerned.
But the reality is, when I'm talking to farmers, sustainability is coming up constantly. It's a number one topic for us. It's not that we're not aware, but as I say, it's often difficult to put in place with the cost of investment on some measures and the cost of changing on different products that people are just not aware of. If we can achieve those things, I think we can significantly reduce and ultimately meet the aims of being carbon neutral by 2050.
Agriculture is a 13 billion euro export business. Can that sort of business and output be consolidated while at the same time be more sustainable environmentally?
The easiest way for us to be more sustainable and to meet those challenges is very clear. For more of that 13 to go back to the farmer, to go back to the primary producer so that he can invest, and for very clear market incentives for him or her to be more climate friendly, to be water quality. At the moment, the market is not returning. We see constantly claims of people want more sustainability. But in every single consumer survey, we see that climate change is not the priority. The priority is cost, or the priority is taste. Welfare and climate is certainly moving up the area, but it's not to the same extent that, unfortunately, the consumer is paying farmers for it.
Like, I don't think we've ever had a national discussion of what kind of agriculture we would like here. And there's a significant amount of public money supporting agriculture. And it would be great if we could actually have an agri-food strategy that was developed where people were presented with different models of what we could have in this country, recognising soil types, and present the pros and cons of each, and let's actually have a proper discussion. We've never had that.
Is that not what Strategy 2030 is all about?
Well, actually, I don't think it was exactly part of its remit to go into that level of teasing out all of the issues. And we've not seen that level of engagement with the public at all. So there will be a public consultation on the strategy, but unfortunately, our past experience with consultations is often that once the strategy is kind of done and dusted, there's very little done after the fact in terms of tweaking. Whereas what would be good is if you had a public debate, like online webinars, inviting people, it's on the news, it's in the media, people are talking about it. We really haven't had that level of engagement.
The discussion or the debate on both sides remains quite adversarial. we're not getting any closer to working together between agriculture and the environment, it seems.
No, and that's incredibly disappointing to me, because I think there is both great opportunity for both sides to actually engage and listen to each other. And that was a majorly valuable contribution that the environmental pillar were making to these and are on other committees that I sit along. I think the only thing that I would certainly reject is the idea that anyone but the farm organisations, who are made up of farmers, are not representing their members. All the farm organisations, we may differ in our positions, but I'm absolutely certain that every one of them is doing their job to represent farmers. And the implication that we are not, or that we are bought off, or some other incredibly hurtful, negative thing, is really driving a massive wedge between both communities.
Mochrane Farmer President Thomas Duffy there, and the Home Farm in Cavan, and before that the Head of Advocacy with Birdwatch Ireland, Una Duggan. And that Agri-Food Strategy 2030 is due for publication in a few weeks' time, and we will come back to it then. Now, it's been a difficult week for horse racing, but life goes on and racing continues, and Suzanne Campbell has been chatting to a few people this week ahead of Cheltenham, which is coming up, of course. Suzanne, good morning to you.
Good morning. Yes, Damien, it's been a difficult time for many people in racing, and also the public at large, who were just appalled by the photo of Irish trainer Gordon Elliott sitting on a dead horse that was being shared on social media last week. The investigation into this incident by the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board, it concluded yesterday evening, as a lot of people heard, and Gordon Elliott's licence was suspended for a year with the final 6 months suspended. And the racing community, I suppose, they feel they want to move forward again, with the welfare of the horse being really front and centre of the sport. And I suppose thousands of people this morning, it's just after 8 o'clock, they're already probably on their second lot exercising. They've mucked out, they're tacking up, they're, putting horses on walkers. And really, over 150 Irish horses will be travelling from next week to the Cheltenham Festival over in the Cotswolds. Also about over 100 stable staff, 30-odd jockeys and 30-odd trainers. So I asked trainer Joseph O'Brien, with the festival behind closed doors this year and with the Brexit and COVID difficulties, is there still the same excitement in his yard in Kilkenny as in previous years?
Yeah, absolutely. The Cheltenham Festival is the top week's racing in national hunt racing of the season. And I suppose a bit of apprehension and a little bit of nerves at the moment, so far as, most of the work is done. And now it's just about the finishing touches going on the horses. Some of them have their last school and their last little breezes before they travel over. So a little bit apprehensive and a little bit of nerves at this stage.
Now, obviously with COVID, you've staff traveling over. Has that been quite a body of work to get that done?
Yes, all of the Irish people travelling over, the trainers and jockeys are going to be in an Irish bubble, and the staff in an Irish bubble. They won't mix with any of the UK-based trainers or staff. The Irish jockeys won't mix with any of the UK jockeys. They have to have 3 COVID tests before travelling, and everybody's in, I think it's called an Irish zone or an Irish bubble, basically. So the horses are separated, completely separate to the UK runners. Mm-hmm. So it took an awful lot of organisation and an awful lot of work behind the scenes between the HRI, the IHRB and the BHA in the UK. And, they really had to come together and figure out the logistics of such a big number of people and horses travelling. It is going to be different, but I suppose everything in every walk of life this year has been different. I don't think anyone's life around the world hasn't been touched some way. And like I say, we're lucky that we've been able to keep racing, and it's going to be a fantastic week racing. Although there won't be anyone there, there will be huge numbers of people watching from around the world, and very lucky that we are able to take part there this season, and it promises to be a fantastic week's racing.
Ireland has worked really closely with the UK authorities on keeping the English and Irish staff, trainers and jockeys apart at Cheltenham. And that's really the novel thing about this festival. Irish jockeys will actually even have a separate weigh room to jockeys living or working in the UK. I talked to Jennifer Pugh. She's a senior medical officer for the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board. And I asked her what preparing the Irish contingent for these extreme COVID protocols, if you like, has been like.
Yeah, so we have a very thorough process, very robust protocols in place. You know, we've been fortunate in this country that the government have given approval since last autumn for the elite sports at international level to continue. And we've seen that with the other sports at international level. And Cheltenham is our biggie. It's our Olympics, if you like. And obviously, slightly different to other team sports, we are at a greater advantage because we're in the outdoors and we're not a contact sport. But it does involve the movement of people because we have both equine and human athletes to consider here. So we have around 25, 26 jockeys who'll be attending the meeting, around 27 or 8 trainers confirmed to travel. There's obviously more trainers with runners, but several are not traveling this year. And the stable staff number is probably going to come in around 100, which is much less than the number of horses we have running. And the yards have been really good to make sure that they limit and that they're really going on a shoestring, really, in terms of the number of people that they need to run things when we get over there. And the protocols, everyone will need a pre-departure test within 72 hours. And that's not a requirement of the UK, but we're testing everybody regardless before they go, just, I suppose, to reassure everybody that we're not sending anybody over who may have active infection. And then when people are in Cheltenham, they'll be required to be tested to allow them to come back into Ireland, because it is a requirement, as you know, to have a negative COVID test within 72 hours of coming back to Ireland. And then obviously everyone will be tested again at day 5, which is what the current guidelines recommend, that a negative test at day 5 means you can end your quarantine. And we've had an enhanced testing programme in place for the jockeys, which started last week and will continue this weekend.
And in terms of the staff that go over there, there are going to be separate bubbles. Tell us about that. Team Ireland, if you like, remain together throughout the festival.
Yeah, this is quite unique to racing because obviously everyone involved is an individual. They go there and as their individual yard. But for the purposes of managing the people in Cheltenham, we are going to be Team Ireland in an Irish bubble. There is an Irish zone at Cheltenham, and that's where everybody will stay for the week. So nobody leaves the Cheltenham site. They don't leave the Irish zone within the Cheltenham site. And we stay there for the entirety of time that you're there to compete. Particularly when you think of Cheltenham taking crowds of 50, 60,000 per day at a meeting, we're only going to have a few hundred people there. So when you spread everybody out and use all of those facilities, it is very manageable and we're very able to keep everybody apart.
In terms of Irish horses going to the UK, you know, I reported on this issue on Countrywide in January, and it was clear then that the early chaos that Brexit was really causing at ports and regarding transport of animals. And, you know, while it was hoped then that the customs issue of having to pay 20% of the value of a horse before it travelled would be cleared up, that is sadly not the case. I talked to Sarah Parsons from Mullins Transport in Kilkenny yesterday. It's one of Ireland's biggest equine transport companies. And not only did they have to get their lorries to the UK to be approved to actually travel in the UK with horses, but their staff also had to do a course in equine travel to operate in the UK, despite them doing this job for years. And also the restrictions and paperwork on bringing Irish horses in is still really prohibitive. So Sarah took me through what's been happening with the Irish Cheltenham runners.
For temporary exports, so like the Cheltenham runners, the horses will have to, first of all, complete the health papers. So they complete the health papers with their local vet, then followed by the department vet. The import system in the UK has to be pre-notified. Then we have to submit the completed health papers to the import system. And that's quite complex in itself, but very much doable. Then there's the second part of it is the customs side. And these horses are being temporarily exported to a third country. The most straightforward option is to export these horses on what's called a carne. And a carne is, you can open it with the Chambers of Commerce here in Dublin, but you have to put the deposit, the bonds down as a 20% of the commercial value of the animal has to be paid in a deposit bonds. So that you can secure that horse, you will go to a third country, but you will also return. And when you return, your bonds will be refunded to you.
So yes. Does that mean that there's trainers with, you know, really high value animals going over and lower value animals? But if I was a trainer, for example, with a runner that was worth 100,000 euro, I still have to pay then 20,000 euro in a bond. I will get it back, but I have to have that money liquid and ready to go to even have the horse compete in the UK.
Yes, you'd have to pay your bonds down as the commercial value. Now, what commercial value is declared on the animal is up to the trainer, up mm-hmm. to the owner. It's for them to declare themselves. And you have to have 4 stamps on this carne in order to prove that that horse has been exported and it has returned correctly in order to get your bonds back.
So that's still an incredible, unwieldy situation. I mean, we're sending over 150, 160 perhaps runners from Ireland next week, I can't think of the value that owners and parties must be paying to just even ship them over and have them run.
Exactly. It's a colossal amount of work. And I think everybody was hoping that they were going to get something set up in place of this. But at the minute, they haven't.
No getting away from that Brexit disaster for a lot of different sectors. That was Sarah Parsons from Mullins Transport in Kilkenny chatting there to Suzanne Campbell. Thanks a million, Suzanne, for that report. And let's hope all racing fans now can just get back to enjoying the racing in Cheltenham. Next week, you're listening to Countrywide here on RTE Radio 1.
RTE Radio 1. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Have you cattle to sell? Find out what they're worth with our Mart price calculator on farmersjournal.ie.
At Home on the Farm is the name of a new exhibition at the Limerick City Gallery of Art. The artist Mary Burke has painted life on five farms in County Limerick. Now, June Danaher's farm is one of those featured, and Ella McSweeney visited her to find out about her farming life.
My name is June Danaher, and we're here in Shanagolden. I'm farming here for 41 years. I'm married into the farm. I'm a suckler farmer and I'm also a social farmer, and I have an array of animals. We're standing here with Spirit the pony, Cisco the alpaca, Anna, Eddie and Scommel the goats. So they're all pets. So and then over here we have the cows and the calves. Let the lads in because... So these are suckler cows, and these are all pedigrees, Limousin, and the ones that are bawling are looking for nuts, they're pets in the middle. So farming, I'm not from a farming background, I'm from North Lincolnshire. The reason I'm here in Ireland, I met an Irishman and married him. Well, I came on holiday, met Jared on a Saturday, and the following Friday he asked me to marry him. So, yeah, I settled in very well. I suppose I had a good baptism with Jared's father. We were dairy farmers back then, so I made lots of mistakes. It was hard work in the beginning because it was all new to me. I can remember Jared's father, we'd go out, he'd say, come out, they were milking the cows, and he'd say to me, you know, wash the teats. And I can remember the first time I came out with a bucket of water with very liquid and a cloth. And he said, what the, are you doing? I said, I'm washing them. Do you know what I mean? You just clean them with fresh water. I didn't know that. And another time, that when you give them the nuts to the cows, you say a scoop of nuts, which meant the handful, and I'd be giving each cow a bucket of nuts, and Jared's father, he'd be going along after me and putting some back in the bucket. So it was a learning process. I just loved it. I loved when cows calved, and it's as exciting today as it was all the, you know, them years ago. So no, I really, really like it. It rips out. So these two were born on Friday of last week. And then the calves that are in the far off pen, they were all born within the last 6 to 8 weeks. The gates are designed that the calf can go in and out to drink the mum, and then they come back out into the bed. They're all very friendly. So there's 70 acres on the farm here, and it's broken out, it's all in paddocks, so when the cows go out, pedigrees go at one side and the commercial go at the other side. I was asked would I get involved with the social farming. I knew nothing about it, so I said yes, I'd give it a try. So I have young men with intellectual disabilities that come to the farm on a Tuesday. My lads that come, that they've been coming to me now over to nearly 3 years. So all the lads have ability, but I suppose sometimes it's not till you do something like this that they realise what they can do. So we decided we'd slate walls. We built this wall here and we're making a step here. Now, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes time. But as you can see, we built the wall and we slated the walls. The reason I do it is to give back and to be thankful for what we have. You know, this, we're so lucky. They're not. Life gives you a bum hand sometimes. Sorry. It's not pity. I don't have pity for the boys. But it's just life is hard. And not everybody has been as lucky as my children or as lucky as I've been. So, no, I love the social farming. They're excited to come and they're part of the family. COVID has been tough. The boys couldn't come. Some of them have underlying problems and they actually closed down the centres, so a lot of them had to go home. So there was nothing for them either, which has been hard. But look, things are starting to improve. Numbers are going down. So hopefully we can get back. We're in the chicken pen now, so I have khaki Campbell ducks, an array of hens, Rhode Island reds, a few lavender, a few blacks, and my rooster. So I get on average about 20 eggs a day. I think women are the backbone of the farms, and going back historically, there wasn't enough recognition for women on the farm. It's different today because I suppose women are more vocal. They're not in the background anymore, they're at the forefront of farming. I'd like to see, I suppose, more women on the boards, you know, IFA, things like this, because it is dominated by men. So are the marts. The marts are dominated, it's all male. I don't think women get listened to. You know, I've been to meetings and you could put forward, you could ask a question, you don't always get an answer. It's like, and if you go to any of the meetings, also, there's very few women participating from the floor. And I think that needs to be broken. You know, we need to be more vocal. About a year ago, I got a phone call from Mary Burke, the artist, asking could she come out to the farm, and I assumed it was to do with social farming. Mary came to the farm, she took some photographs, it was a grey day. We went into the house, she took a few photographs in the house. She said that she was going to do paintings. They actually sent me some of them. She did paintings of bulls, the goats, the alpaca, the dog. It was nice because we take things for granted, I think, at times. We don't realise what beautiful views we have, and it was just refreshing to have somebody here to see, I suppose, what we see every day. But it was like she was seeing it for the first time.
Ella McSweeney there walking with June Danaher across her farm in Shanagolden in County Limerick. And you can see Mary Burke's paintings, beautiful paintings indeed, of June's farm at the Limerick City Gallery of Art at gallery.limerick.ie, because of course it's online, and the exhibition and programme of events runs at the gallery until the 2nd of May. And June will also participate in an online live event this Monday as part of International Women's Day at Limerick City Gallery of Art. That will be at 2 o'clock and Mary will be there along with four artists, farmers including Lisa Fingleton, Sheila Flanagan and Breda Larkin. So thanks to Ella for that report. Now, our friend and colleague John Creedon is back on the road again, exploring Ireland in Creedon's Irish Atlas, which airs at tea time tomorrow on RTÉ1 television. John explores the history, archaeology, folklore and place names that shape this land in this series. Here's a little taste of what's in store as John and Ardal O'Hanlon explore Ballinspittle in County Cork. Both men wanted to know what the place name meant, and local historian Jerome Lorden explained the influence of leprosy on the Irish place names.
But the thing about leprosy, what you must understand, is that leprosy encompassed smallpox, plague, people who felt bad, yeah. looked bad. They're all called lepers.
Yeah, I mean, in a time before penicillin, it was just a case of containing them, really, wasn't it? And
yes.
and we discovered those all over the place, like Gortnalower, the Field of the Lepers,
yes. yeah.
and Lover's Walk in Cork, apparently.
Yes. Yeah. That was Bournalower.
Spiddle in Galway. Is that the
Spiddle?
Same derivation?
And Hospital in Limerick.
Spiddale.
Yes,
and Hospital.
Hospital in County Limerick.
Spiddle Hill in Kinsale, and there's Tubbernalower. In Spiddle in Kinsale.
The whale of the lepers.
I can take you to see one now, one of the best known whales in the area.
You up for that?
John Creedon, good morning to you and congratulations. It looks like another lovely tapestry of colour, sound, voices and intriguing information, but you're more than just the presenter. You know, when I was looking at it last year, and indeed I got a sneak preview of what's happening tomorrow, you're as into this stuff as you are into Cork hurling.
I'm an amateur enthusiast all my life, I suppose. For my mom and my dad, I got to grow up for the place names. I spent a lot of time, obviously, in the countryside growing up with roots there. And academically, I went back to UCC and did a couple of years folklore and Baileadh is the same thing, really, I suppose, and history and a bit of that. But really, I would only describe myself as an enthusiastic amateur. I've got a great draw for it. But I've been surrounded on this series, as with the last, by academics. But again, driven by the same enthusiasm for the people who walk these fields and walk these footpaths before us. So it is, that's the draw, really. And in that case, Jerome Lorden, very enthusiastic man. He knows Kinsale at the back of his hand. So what we did there actually was, it was the trip. It was like the trip to the Holy Well. It was the priest, the professor, and the presenter. So we had Ardal O'Hanlon, who was there in 1985 for the moving statue, as I was myself. And we had Professor Luke O'Neill came along, and he tested the waters and the wells to see if the science would back up the belief system in the area. And we got some amazing results, actually. Very interesting.
Yeah, and as you said there, you had people like Geraldine Stout from the National Monuments Service and Shane Lahan, who teaches in this field. Was it difficult, though, filming last year with COVID and all of that? Because it doesn't seem, you know, to have impinged on it at all.
No, it doesn't. It seems so long ago because we were the longest time waiting for the green light. And obviously, there's a demand there for television and for radio during a pandemic. So clearly, people want fresh material. And we were trying to get history, folklore, blue skies, hedgerows, forest bushes, Montbretia, and all the beauty of the Irish countryside and the stories. But we had to wait and wait and wait, and eventually we got a green light. We had devised, not me so much now, but the technical people had devised a new way of actually filming. So the only thing we lost, really, were the big community colourful events that we had in the past, like Ishnacht. So there are no flaming torchlight processions or horses' hooves and that kind of stuff. That's been dropped. Mm. Just for this year anyway, at least.
Yeah.
But we did get some great stories. We got some wonderful stories and just great people. And I think particularly with people rediscovering Ireland, whatever about Discover Ireland, a lot of people are saying, God, I've forgotten what a beautiful country it is.
Yeah.
So last summer, people probably were tutting at the notion of being confined to the island for their holidays. But the reports back were huge, and I got a lot of texts and tweets and so on to the programme from people saying, God, we're only sorry we didn't have you in the camper van with us to tell us what the foreign means or what this means. So that's why I did the book as well. It was something I wanted to do myself, but the timing seems to have been perfect because there's a wave of new interest in who we are, where we've come from, and just a love of country, love of place.
Yeah,
with the 5KMs, we're locked down now as well, so you might as well get to know the area.
Yeah, absolutely. The Place We Call Home is out in paperback this weekend. That's your new book. And we mentioned there about the revolution of the drone, and it just paints the picture beautifully. But Geraldine, I want to bring you in here at this point because John talked there about the 5K radius, and I was chatting to Emma Gillies, who's an architectural historian, a couple of weeks ago, to give her some credit on this, because she said, don't talk about 5K, talk about the 41K circumference that you can actually travel and explore. So if you get a good map, there's lots to see.
Absolutely. I wouldn't go anywhere without a Northern Survey 6-inch to a mile map, because that just it just shows you all the buildings and the mills and the forges and the schools and the barracks that are in your area. And we're just so lucky in Ireland because every part of it is saturated with historic, with interesting historical buildings and archaeological monuments. And one of the websites I would certainly advise your listeners to look up is the Historic Environment Viewer, which has been developed by the National Monument Service. And in that viewer, when you go into it, you could look at any part of Ireland and it will show you where the archaeology is and where the historic buildings are, and will tell you a bit about them. So there's no part, no matter where you are, you can look up and then you can rediscover the archaeology and the buildings of your own area.
And
you know, it's as John said, it's the excitement of discovery, which is what it's all about.
Yeah, and the map is a great idea, Geraldine.
Yeah,
but
the
Shane,
map is a great idea.
But Shane, if you don't have, Shane Lahan, if you don't have a map, the local graveyard.
Absolutely. I would just say, you know, the landscape is just full of these clues to the past of the place. And just, you know, walk along the road and just look for your old stone buildings.
Yes.
Look for your mills, and your forges. And try and understand, you know, what is the history of your area.
Shane?
You know, and I would also, you know, parish histories. There's always a parish history.
There is.
Which can tell you about it. And, you know, there's nothing like discovering a place that you've been walking, you've known the area for years, but to walk and rediscover a new place, it's a great thrill.
Yep. I'm here. Yeah. So listen, I'm listening to Geraldine, and she's saying exactly everything I'm thinking of. But there's so many things. I think what's great about John's program is it lets us see what you might call the extraordinary in the ordinary. You know, John has a great way of looking at the world through the eyes of a child, and I think when within our own 5K at the moment, it's something we should all start doing. You know, I'm interested in looking at everything and anything. I broaden out the definition of an archaeological site because my students at the moment, they're doing surveys for me, but they're not now able to look for the ring forts and the standing stones and the megaliths and so on. Mm. They're now looking at everything from tinny sheds and mill races and
at one stage I looked at farmyards, and you can actually write the history of Irish farm grants from just looking at a farmyard, because you can see the different types of sheds that were built and the different types of grants that are available, you know. So there's kind of a history in just a farmyard. The banks and ditches that you know, they're just part so familiar to us.
Yeah, well,
you know how they're all kind of 18th century.
Sure, sure. Geraldine, I tell you, you could do a whole program on all of this. And there is one coming up tomorrow night at 6:30 on RT1, and it's the first of the new series of Creedence Irish Atlas. I could talk to you forever, but I'm afraid, guys, I'm going to have to let you go there. But look, it's a nice little taste, and it'll keep people interested because they'll want to hear from you all over the next few weeks. And I know tomorrow, Shane, you have a wonderful piece there in relation to the history of Buttevant in particular. So that's tomorrow on RT1 at 6:30. If you really want to break away from all the doom and gloom, I guarantee you, you can hold me to it. It's a wonderful programme, and well done to John Creedon, and thanks to the guys there for chatting to us. I was actually looking back at the running order for this programme this weekend last year, because it was really the last normal programme before we went into that first wave and lockdown and all of that. And among our guests that morning was Maura McElhone. Now, you'll know Maura, who has contributed to Countrywide over the years, telling us about meeting a farmer, falling in love with a farmer and marrying a farmer. Now, all the same farmer, Jack, as we know. And this time last year, she popped into studio to tell us that she was pregnant and expecting her first baby in May. So we're going to leave you this morning on the programme with Maura looking back over the last 12 months of a very adventurous life in her home.
I place my son in his cot and creep across his room, thankful for the newly laid carpets that spare us both the slap and scratch of my slippers against bare concrete. Gently, I pull the door closed behind me and tiptoe up the hall. My footsteps echo, but in daylight the sound is not so ominous as it is at night, when the large, still curtainless windows flood the house with the thick blackness that envelops the countryside once the sun goes down. Jack, baby and I have been in the house just 2 weeks, the move to his family farm finally complete. Nestled in beautiful rural North Kildare, the house is filled with light and with potential, a space that will, one day, please God, play host to family meals around the table, to birthday parties and visits from grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins and friends. Right now, of course, all of those things, they are but the stuff of dreams to look forward to when all of this is over. For many, these past 12 months mark the year that never was, a lost year. For me, it was also the year that I became a mother, in the most unforeseen circumstances. A last trimester that played out during the nation's first lockdown, a baby shower that took place via Zoom. It was through FaceTime and photographs that my family and friends kept track of my ever-growing bump. Through WhatsApp that, come May, they inquired daily, "Well, are you still with us?" "Still here," I'd reply, until I wasn't. At 11:58 p.m. on May 18th, my waters broke. My son was born at 8:58 a.m. the following morning. My parents' first grandchild, he was 6 weeks old by the time they met him, making the journey from Derry to Kildare only as soon as restrictions allowed. Holding him against my chest, I opened the front door just in time to see Mummy already halfway across the car park, her eyes disclosing the smile that her mask did its best to hide, her arms outstretched. 15 minutes. They can hold him for 15 minutes, was my doctor's advice when I asked if it could be done safely. "I thought you'd have him on display in the Moses basket," said my mummy later that evening, "bringing us in to do the official unveiling. I didn't expect to see you standing there with him over your shoulder, as if he'd always been here." I suppose I'd forgotten that to all the family he hadn't yet met, he was still very much brand new. 9 months on, during our daily FaceTimes, Mummy often comments on how small he looks still. She sounds relieved, eager to spend some real time with her first grandchild, to spoil and dote on him while he is still just a baby. Here in the new house, our guest room lies waiting. Life on COVID terms is all my son has known. His world is as small as he is, my husband and I and the walls in which we live, the measure of it. When I hold my beautiful boy, I feel it all. Pride at bringing him into the world in these most trying of times. The upset and unfairness of knowing that we have missed out on so much. Still, this pared back existence, the intensity of our time together cut off from the rest of the world, it has forged a bond that I'm not sure would exist were it not for the circumstances imposed on us by COVID. The joy he brings me every day in itself is almost childlike. All-encompassing and pure. He makes me feel love, boundless and uncontainable, a wondrous love that, intangible and weightless though it is, steadies me during these turbulent times. Where previously I would be waylaid by worry and anxiety, their pull on me is much weaker now that he is here, my anchor to the present. In the sheds adjacent to our house, the yos have started lambing. Down the hall, my baby sleeps. New life is all around. I'm standing in the kitchen now, and springtime sun pours through the windows. In its rays, hope floats.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Have you cattle to sell? Find out what they're worth with our Mart Price Calculator on farmersjournal.ie.